Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the United Educators Developments in Employment Law webcast. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the conference, please press star, then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this conference call is being recorded. I would now like to introduce your host for today's conference, Ms. Hillary Pettigrew.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the United Educators Telephone Roundtable. I'm Hillary Pettigrew, Risk Counsel at UE, and I'll be the moderator for today's program, in which our speakers will discuss three very different but timely employment topics. The first part of the program will address employee use of online social media and whether institutions can monitor it. In the second portion, we'll turn to recent amendments to the Americans with Disabilities Act. Finally, the third part of the program will address issues of gender equity in faculty pay, particularly in light of the recently passed Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act. We'll have a separate question and answer period after each segment of the roundtable. I'm pleased to introduce our speakers, Richard Paul and Kathleen Reinhardt. Rich is a founding partner of Paul Plevin, Sullivan, and Connaughton in San Diego. He has practiced employment and education law for many years and represents and provides on-campus training for both private and public institutions, including several campuses within the University of California system. Hello, Rich. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Hillary. Good day to all on this call.
And Kathleen is a partner at White Hirschbach Dudek in Milwaukee and heads its education practice. She's a member of UE's Legal Advisory Committee, serves as outside general counsel to several higher education institutions and K-12 schools, and she frequently trains her education clients on employment law issues. Hi, Kathleen. Thanks for participating in the roundtable.
Thanks very much, Hillary. It's a pleasure to be with all of you today.
Before we get started, I'd like to quickly take care of a few housekeeping matters. Recently, we sent everyone registered for today's program some reference materials. If you did not receive those materials, please contact us at risk@ue.org. At the end of the program, we also ask that you please fill out the evaluation form. We value your feedback and will use it to improve future roundtables. We're taping today's program, as we do all our roundtables, and the MP3 file will be available shortly on our website, www.ue.org. Finally, I need to remind everyone that these roundtables are not designed to provide legal advice. You'll be able to ask the speakers questions in two ways, by email or by calling in. At any time during the program, you can email a question by sending it to risk@ue.org. If you wish, feel free to specify in your message that you want your question to remain anonymous, and we'll certainly respect that. The email address to use, again, is risk@ue.org. I'll give you instructions after each program segment on how to call in with questions for Kathleen and Rich. We'll address as many of your questions as possible, but we may not be able to answer all of them. Now let's get started with the first part of our program. Kathleen, the overwhelming majority of inquiries that UE gets about social media involve Facebook. In what employment context does Facebook usually arise?
Well, Hillary, there are several areas of concern that arise. The first is checking Facebook accounts during the hiring process. That is, using access to Facebook account sites as a means to determine potentially whether an employment offer will be made or withdrawn. A second area of concern is inappropriate postings or misbehavior on Facebook sites by a current employee, whether that employee is at work or potentially off-site. And the third is harassment of coworkers on Facebook, either by some form of cyberbullying, some form of defamation, or other inappropriate postings.
Okay. Let's start with the point on hiring. I've seen surveys indicating that approximately 50% of employers may view Facebook accounts of prospective hires. Rich, what advice would you give employers who do this?
Well, first we have to understand the current lay of the legal land. The EEOC has adopted uniform guidelines on employee selection practices, and those guidelines as yet have not been amended to deal one way or another with the issue of Facebook or other internet searching. The problem employers face is that doctrines of negligent hire force the employer to do increasingly due diligence in order to sift through the backgrounds of employees, but at the same time, a Facebook or Internet search may reveal information about the applicant that is not permissible information to ask under the current version of the EEOC selection criteria. So my advice is as follows. Number one, if an employer is going to use Facebook or search Facebook for information in the hiring process, it's best to wait until the employer has already selected finalists for the position, and preferably even at the point where interviews have been conducted. In a face-to-face interview, one gets information about age and race and other information simply by meeting the candidate. There is one lawsuit that I'm aware of that's been filed by an academic candidate who claimed that he was excluded by a search committee that did a Facebook search early on in the process, eliminated him as a candidate for a position. So what you have to understand is by searching Facebook, it's the equivalent of making an ask about information, and if the information comes back and it contains information that is not permissible under the guidelines, that can be a problem. Number next, it is not permissible to use deceit in any way to obtain Facebook information, such as creating a fake person to friend the job candidate or the like. Next, if a Facebook search would reveal forbidden data, be certain that it is not used in the hiring process. That's the greatest common sense protection that I can suggest to anyone.
Okay. Thank you, Rich. Kathleen, let's move on to employee misbehavior on Facebook. What would you advise if an institution becomes aware that an employee posted, say, potentially threatening material on his or her Facebook account?
Well, Hillary, the key phrase that you just mentioned in your question is the concept of what is potentially threatening. And I would certainly advise that all threats are taken seriously, and it's much more important to err on the side of caution. It also will be important to have more than one reviewer of the posting. So the concept of don't do this alone is really key. For individuals, especially those who are in decision-making positions of authority. Many of the representatives from higher education campuses or from K-12 districts that are on the line are likely very familiar with threat assessment teams on their campuses or in their districts, or with established protocols or due diligence to assess the nature of a posting and to determine the level of threat that may be posed. And if threat assessment teams or protocols to do this type of assessment do not exist, it's really important to sit down and take a close look at putting that together. For example, in early 2010, there was a professor at a Pennsylvania university who was suspended for allegedly joking, that is, making comments on her Facebook page about the need for a discreet hitman, and describing a day as good when she did not want to kill students. Despite the fact that the Facebook page for this professor was set at the highest privacy settings, someone was able to access the page and anonymously alerted the university. The university at that time did not have a policy on monitoring faculty social media use, but said that it was obligated to take all threats seriously, and suspended the professor. The professor ultimately was reinstated after a psychological evaluation, but the institution defended its approach and said that it acted appropriately because it needed to determine what actual or potential threat may have existed. Ultimately, what this example shows is that it's important for not only effective follow-up, but really effective prevention in the development of clear policies that are consistently applied and effective policy, ongoing policy review.
Okay. And Kathleen, what have you seen happen when employees post material on their Facebook accounts that schools consider in some way inappropriate but not threatening?
And many of these situations that arise are going to be very fact-specific, which the fact that, you know, all you need to do is tweak these a little bit and change the facts a little bit makes it all the more important to establish a clear policy and clear protocols by which these situations can be reviewed, and also to ensure that ad hoc responses that might otherwise be inappropriately done by an institution are avoided. But that being said, there are a couple of examples where school employees actually lost their jobs due to their inappropriate use of Facebook. One example is a high school administrator in Massachusetts was asked to resign not too long ago after Facebook postings that described parents as arrogant, as snobby, described students as germ bags. She ultimately admitted her error and the mistake in creating these postings and admitted that if she were in the position of the district decision makers, she probably would have come to the same conclusion with regard to its response to these inappropriate postings. She further suggested that students and others view what happened to her as a cautionary tale about how Facebook should not be used. In another example, we have a Georgia high school substitute teacher who was forced to resign after anonymous email alerted the principal to postings that recorded her vacation. Some of the photos that she had posted showed her with alcohol in hand. Another posting referred to her as playing crazy bitch bingo, and she was dismissed. She sued to get her job back. In this particular case, you know, we can see, for example, that we have a substitute who, in a district that is operating, where the faculty are operating under a collective bargaining agreement, that this substitute may not, for example, have rights under that collective bargaining agreement, and therefore it places the district in a very different position to react to these postings and the appropriateness of these postings in a very different way than if this had been a full-time tenured member of the faculty who was covered under the collective bargaining agreement. So again, it's very important to have clear policy and protocols to apply to an assessment of these situations.
Thanks, Kathleen. Rich, let's talk briefly about harassment on Facebook. Assume that one of your education clients receives an employee's complaint that she was told another employee is making sexist comments about her on his Facebook page. The alleged harasser has maximum privacy settings on his Facebook page, meaning that the institution can't directly view it. What would you advise this client to do?
Well, the first thing, Hillary, that I think we need to understand is that in this respect, Facebook is very different from email. Email is typically owned by the employer, run on the employer's server, and under a law called the Stored Communications Act, the employer can access email that is processed through its server. Not so with Facebook or, for that matter, Twitter and other personal services. The holder or owner of the message or communication is the actual Facebook account holder. So the question is how to access the information that would shed light on whether or not harassment has occurred. Secondly, let's keep in mind that it's well established in most jurisdictions now that harassment that takes place of an employee off-site via an off-site communication mechanism still is a matter of concern for the employer if it affects the workplace. And so there is an institutional obligation to investigate. That then leads us to the question, well, what can the institution do? In your hypothetical, the institution can't view the page directly, but it can ask and should ask who told the accuser of the offensive postings. And that person, if contacted and a statement is taken from them, can be asked and can describe what he or she saw or read on the Facebook account in question. in that respect, that interview is much like it would be in any ordinary sexual harassment or other harassment investigation. As a caution, however, that individual should not be asked to give a password to the Facebook account to the institution. As I mentioned earlier, there are some cases that suggest that where the employer obtains access to privately controlled media through false pretenses, such as posing or coercing someone to give a password, that can create problems. Now, there's another approach, too. The accused, of course, in any good investigation, must have a chance to tell his or her side of the story and can be asked, and in my view, should be asked, not only about what was posted on the Facebook page, but can be asked to provide a copy of the information on the Facebook page. If the alleged harasser decides to share the information, then you have it. If the alleged harasser decides not to share the information, but you have credible evidence from others who say, I saw it, and this is what it was, I believe that an inference can be drawn adversely against the Facebook account holder for not providing exculpatory evidence. That's a classic permissible inference in any kind of investigation. So I think that's the way to treat harassment via Facebook.
Okay. I'd just like to give the audience a quick heads up that we'll have our first question and answer opportunity in a few moments. You can email your question to risk@ue.org, or if you'd prefer to call in with a question for Kathleen or Rich, just press *1 on your touchtone phone and you'll be put in line to ask a question. If you decide not to ask your question, just press the pound key and that will take you out of the queue. In the meantime, Rich, what lessons can we take from the examples Kathleen gave a few minutes ago and the hypothetical situation that you just discussed?
Well, it seems to me the first lesson is that we should all understand, whether we're employer representatives or users of Facebook, that there's no such thing as total privacy on Facebook. There are a number of recent cases in which in divorce or in personal injury cases or claims, lawyers adverse to the Facebook holder have been seeking court orders requiring that data that otherwise would be under a privacy screen be revealed, and in New York at least, a judge recently ordered that privacy setting could be penetrated. There's also, frankly, nothing to control friends from revealing data that is posted on Facebook pages that are somewhat privacy restricted. So it simply makes common sense to assume that whatever privacy setting is being placed may be penetrable. Next, it seems to me, institutions need to do two things here. Number one, with respect to behavior on private Facebook or other social media, many institutions have adopted what you might call common sense ethics policies, reminders of protocol and appropriate behavior when discussing colleagues, when discussing institutional issues on private Facebook accounts. Second, institutions should consider and adopt policies on use and on protocols for communication on institutionally controlled or institutionally endorsed Facebook pages or settings. There is an increasing use of Facebook by faculty in the process of teaching and in relationships with students, and in these cases, it's a quasi-institutional use that needs to be regulated not only for behavior, but also for abuse of the technology itself. Those are my suggestions.
Thank you. Now we'll have our first question and answer opportunity for the audience. Once again, you can email your questions to risk@ue.org. And if you'd like to call in with a question, just press *1 on your touchtone phone. We have one question. Rich, some members have asked UE what they should do about teachers, faculty, or other staff having potentially inappropriate contact with students through social media, primarily friending them on Facebook. What general advice would you offer?
Thank you, Hillary. The issue of friending has received a great deal of attention at the K-12 level, and most of the friending cases and controversies have erupted at that level. In general, at that level, there is a much, much greater concern about the role of a teacher as a representative of the community and as a modeler of behavior. Some K-12 districts have adopted policies that forbid friending entirely. Others take the view that they want to educate the educator, so to speak, and teach good interactive behaviors with respect to friending. At the higher education level, there are many fewer outright restrictions on the issue of friending. But my rough sample of colleagues, and I do teach as an adjunct law professor, is that more and more faculty at institutions of higher learning are voluntarily adopting a no-friending policy for students who are currently students in class or otherwise are advisees and the like, to be certain that there is not any appearance of bias. And then after the teaching portion of their interactions is over and done with, welcome former students and the like as friends and colleagues. So there are no cut-and-dried rules, but in general terms, the issue is a much, much more serious and more highly debated one at the K-12 level.
Thanks, Rich. I understand we have one caller on the line. Operator, could you put that call in for us, please?
Thank you. Our caller is from Weston University.
Oh, hi. Yes, this is Angie Clifton, and I just wanted to have a question about the example of on the substitute that was forced to resign. So in the end, that prevailed because she was a substitute. Is that what I understood?
The question is whether that the substitute teacher was able to get her job back, and that case currently is in suit, but she was forced to resign, and the district at the moment, that resignation is still in place.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Now we'll go on to the second part of our program and shift our attention to the Americans with Disabilities Amendments Act, which took effect on January 1st, 2009. The previous version of the ADA defined the term disability in three ways. First, as having a physical or mental impairment that substantially limits a major life activity. Second, having a record of such an impairment. Or third, being regarded as having such an impairment. Kathleen, the amendments really don't seem to change that basic definition, so why do many employment lawyers consider these amendments significant?
Well, Hillary, what has happened here with the amendments and the real underlying importance of the amendments here is that the interpretation of disability has been viewed to be much broader. When you take a look at the legislative history underlying these amendments, that history, legislative history suggests that actually there has been an effort here through the amendments to have the law actually reflect what Congress originally intended. That is, there's a greater emphasis on finding coverage rather than having a greater debate over the nature of the disability or whether the disability exists. Congress has, the interpretation here is to find more coverage, and it actually is now rejecting through these amendments previous case law that actually had narrowed the scope of and the reach of the amendments. In addition, the concept of major life activities is not to be strictly construed under the amendments. That is, there's not an exhaustive list, but the amendments now specifically cover activities such as bending, reading, concentrating, sitting, reaching, interacting with others. Further, the concept of what constitutes a major life activity now includes bodily functions like immune disorders or digestive disorders and reproductive systems. So the thrust of these amendments is to reach back to the original intent of Congress and really do away with the narrowing interpretation by the courts over the years.
Okay, that's a helpful overview. Let's talk about mitigating measures, which are things like medication or, say, a hearing aid that reduce or eliminate the effect of a given impairment. Rich, how did the amendments change the way mitigating measures are treated under the ADA?
Well, as Hillary previewed for us, the amendments were driven by a very, very strong reaction to a series of Supreme Court decisions in the 1990s, chief of which was one called Sutton versus United Airlines, in which the Supreme Court construed the ADA to view the question of whether a disability exists by looking at the individual involved after the individual used all available mitigating measures. So it found in that particular case that people with myopia, with a visual impairment, simply weren't impaired because when they had their glasses on, they could see fine. Therefore, they weren't disabled, and therefore they lost their cases. And studies showed that individuals lost 93% of cases brought under the ADA in the first 10 years. Well, I practice in California and sometimes euphemistically referred to as the People's Republic of California. I mean that as a joke. And here we have a very pro-employee environment, and the state legislature very quickly amended our state version of the ADA to, in essence, adopt a definition different from that the Supreme Court had decided would be under the federal ADA. And basically our definition here under the State Act said that a disability is a condition not that substantially limits a major life activity, but one that simply makes a major life activity more difficult, and that whether a disability is present will be viewed without regard to any mitigation. The purpose of these amendments clearly was to drive the conversation away from an argument about whether disability exists and into the place where disability advocates and others believe the conversation should be, and that is, what can we do to help challenged people succeed? So now, under the ADA amendments, the federal law has essentially adopted what had been the case in California for about the last 8 years, and with the exception of glasses or contact lenses, you can't consider mitigating measures at all when deciding whether or if a person is disabled. So let me give you an example. Suppose you had someone with asthma, and they are on medication, and they're asymptomatic when they're on medication. That is to say, they have no episodes or problems. But the individual requests accommodation of, let's say, moving a desk away from an employee who's wearing perfume. You can no longer simply respond by saying, well, because your medication controls the asthma, you're not disabled, and therefore we don't have to deal with this. What you have to do is to accept that the person does have a qualifying disability and then engage in a conversation about what kind of accommodation would be necessary. A problem, I will tell you, that arises in deciding how to deal with mitigating measures is that they can still be considered in deciding whether accommodation is needed. So in our asthma example, the employer could consider the fact that the employee has asthma medication when considering whether the desk should be moved. But the risk is simply this. All medications are subject to A, not being taken, and B, not being effective. And so making decisions based on the fact that a disabled employee currently has some sort of medication that controls the condition may become much more risky. What becomes really important is that there be an accelerated and particular and strong dialogue with the employee about why the accommodation is being requested and what, if anything, needs to be done beyond corrective medication.
Okay. Kathleen, how has the AD changed in the way it treats impairments that are either episodic or in remission?
Well, thanks, Hillary. And Rich really got this ball rolling in terms of an important clarification under the amendments, and that is that impairments that are episodic or in remission are actually covered if they would be substantially limit a major life activity when those impairments are active. That is, in the example that Rich just used, if someone has asthma, they take medication, but if they didn't take the medication or if there is some other condition or event that may trigger that impairment, such as sitting nearby an employee who wears perfume, we no longer have to debate over whether that impairment exists. It does exist, and it pushes us much more into the discussion of that interactive discussion about what type of reasonable accommodations should occur. What it does on the ground in a practical sense that's very helpful is that it gets us out of the business of thinking that we need to diagnose what's going on here and moves us into the land of effective interactive discussions with regard to potential reasonable accommodations. So in the case, you know, other types of cases beyond asthma also might include major depression, for example, or an individual who suffers from diabetes.
Okay. Our second question and answer period is coming up soon. Before we get to that, Rich, how do you think educational institutions will be impacted by these amendments to the ADA?
Well, Hillary, I think it's a little bit early still to tell the full effects of the amendments, but I do think this, that institutions should prepare and increase education and training of managers and faculty about the interactive process and the duty to accommodate, especially in the areas of emotional, mental, and learning disabilities. I believe that the greatest challenges in the next 10 years under the ADA as amended will be in dealing with these much, much more difficult to assess and to accommodate conditions. It's clear, as I think all of our listeners on this call realize and understand, that these mental and learning conditions are covered as disabilities under the Act. It is less clear in the literature and in practice exactly how to accommodate them. Granted, in educational institutions, there's a reasonably well-developed body of expertise with respect to student learning disabilities and the like, but I think it's less well-developed with respect to employee and faculty emotional and mental disorders of one sort or another. Second, it's clear that future ADA litigation will focus, as our conversation illustrates, not on whether a disability exists, but on whether there has been discrimination, or I think more precisely, on whether there has been an effective interactive dialogue. The law requires that an employer faced with or aware of a disability and a request for accommodation must engage in an interactive process toward determining what accommodations are necessary, and that that process is ongoing. It simply is not sufficient to come up with one idea and stop, or two ideas and stop. It is an ongoing obligation that may require testing out a variety of different accommodations. So I think the training focus should be on educating people to issue SPOT and be aware that that obligation must go forward and that there is real risk of liability to simply ignore or be dismissive of employee requests for a quieter working environment, for a learning environment that is a little bit more conducive, and the like. I think that those are the challenges that we'll see over the next 5 or 10 years under the ADA.
Oh, thanks, Rich. Kathleen, do you have any practical advice for institutions that, as Rich indicated, will likely be facing these challenges in the coming years?
Sure, Hillary. I would suggest to everybody that, you know, despite the fact that these amendments are here, they're in our hands, we're obligated to abide by them, what the law now requires. We're also waiting for some final commentary from the EEOC. This isn't a time to panic in any way. I think that what it does suggest is that the time is now for careful review of current policy and procedure. As Rich mentioned, training is going to be essential, and I think one of the key takeaways from all of the areas that we're going to be discussing here this afternoon is the necessity for training for in-services, especially for those who are charged with the ongoing implementation of applicable policies and procedures. Also, as Rich mentioned, key to success under in terms of compliance with the amendments is being prepared to move affirmatively and effectively into the interactive process. to discuss potential accommodations. And even though an individual is not entitled under the law to the very accommodation that he or she might seek, we are obligated to discuss potential reasonable accommodations. This is really also the time to review job descriptions and postings. Have we clearly identified the essential functions, the academic and technical standards for the positions that exist on our campuses and in our school districts? Have we developed position descriptions, for example, for faculty? It's a time to be proactive, not reactive. And it's essential in examining these position descriptions, whether it's for faculty, for staff, for administrators, that we are prepared to understand and articulate what the underlying legitimate qualifications are for each of these positions, so that if we are faced with a time where it's necessary to engage in this interactive process, we actually are moving forward and not trying to go back.
Great, thank you. And now we'll give our audience another chance to pose questions to Kathleen and Rich. Again, you can email questions to risk@ue.org, or if you'd prefer to call in, press *1 on your touch-tone phone, and you'll be put in line to ask a question. We have one question by email, and I'll direct this one to Rich. After the recent amendments, is current illegal drug use still excluded from coverage as a disability under the ADA?
The answer is yes. Current ongoing illegal drug use is statutorily excluded. However, the way a disability is defined under the ADA is a three-part definition. It is the existence currently of a disability, a record of having had a disability, or being regarded as having a disability. And carrying through that definition, what the regulations suggest is that a drug user who is either currently in rehab or is through a rehabilitative program and is a former drug user may qualify for coverage because the condition of addiction, so long as it does not involve current drug use, is a covered condition. That is to say, it is a disability that moves us then to the next analysis, and that is whether it needs to be accommodated in one form or another.
Thanks, Rich. Operator, I believe we have someone waiting on the phone line to ask a question.
Yes, Weston University, your line is open.
Yes, here I am again. I like the comment made about evaluate job description to make sure everything is in place. So if one, you know, in the case of asthma, do we put in the job description that perfumes or maybe even some smoking of people, you know, my environment will involve that? Is that what you're suggesting be done? I mean, it sounds kind of odd, but I guess maybe that's what needs to be done.
Well, when I referred to the job descriptions earlier, my point there was to take a look at what are the essential functions and qualifications for that position. If you are describing an environment in which that person may be working, you have to be cautious about when this is going to arise, you know, in terms of how you want to say in the job description, people may periodically be wearing perfume on the job, because what you are discussing pre-offer, pre-hire, is from your vantage point, is going to trigger a different set of responsibilities than if the potential candidate for that job raises the issue pre-offer, pre-hire about the nature of a disability or an impairment. And so I think, Rich, I don't know that I necessarily have a comfort level with discussing all the whys and wherefores of each variation under each impairment on a job description, especially when each impairment, you may not necessarily have the same outcome with two people, for example, who have asthma.
Yeah, my two cents here is that One should not try to anticipate and write into every job description every conceivable impairment and limitations that one might want to have in mind based on those impairments. That's just way too difficult a task. The purpose of job descriptions is to define the essential functions of the job. Those are the KSAs, or knowledge, skill, and abilities that are required to do the job. And I think if one focuses on doing a good job of setting forth what the tasks are, that's sufficient. The accommodative process is really the right place to deal with all of the nuances of how one with a particular impairment might be enabled to do a part of the job that is an essential function of the job. So that, for example, if an asthma sufferer, even after medication, has a serious problem because of necessary fumes, because the job is right next to the kitchen, let us say, and simply you can smell the food in the kitchen, and that's something that causes an allergic reaction, then you might be talking about a transfer. But I would not redo the job descriptions to, in each case, say non-allergy to food or food odors is part of the essential functions of the job. It isn't. The essential functions are what the work is.
Okay. Thanks, Rich. I think that's quite helpful. And I think we can squeeze in one more email question here. Rich, do the ADA amendments affect at all either state workers' compensation laws or disability benefit programs?
Yeah, the short answer to that is no. They are not intended to in any way preempt or supplant or change any of those other definitions. And as a practical matter, what that means is that in evaluating the responsibilities toward a worker with a potentially disabling condition, one has to look at the ADA issues using the ADA definitions. One has to look at the workers' comp issues using the workers' comp definitions. And one has to look at the disability insurance or other state disability issues using the definitions under those laws. Each law has a different set of definitions and a different set of requirements, and the job is not to confuse them or overlap them, but to deal with each of them separately under the terms of each of the laws.
Okay, thank you very much. And now we'll move into the final segment of our program today, focusing on the issue of gender equity in faculty pay. You're probably familiar with figures indicating that in many fields, women still earn less than men. For example, a 2007 study by the American Association of University Women found that 1 year after college graduation, women on average were earning 80% of what men were earning, and by 10 years after graduation, the women's pay was only 67% on average of men's. Kathleen, does your experience suggest that women in academia experience a similar pay disadvantage?
Well, Hillary, in order to answer this, in particular taking a look at the AAUW survey, in order to answer this, we need to take a closer look at a number of the academic fields. Whether these fields have historically been more female or male-oriented. But, you know, we also need to take a look at administrative positions, how those administrative positions have been filled, and what patterns of decision-making may exist or have existed along the way that might impact the decision-making with regard to compensation. It's not an easy task, and there are a number of competing surveys over the last couple of years that raise some important but challenging questions with regard to pay equity.
Okay. Now, female faculty members who want to challenge in court their pay as discriminatory on the basis of gender generally have to first file a discrimination charge with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, or EEOC for short. Rich, in your experience, what does the EEOC tend to primarily focus on when they're analyzing such a claim?
Well, having litigated some of these cases, I have at least some insight into what happens in the trenches when The EEOC, at least in our area, is analyzing a case like this. And I don't purport to speak for them, but I am an observer, if you will, of the kind of things that they have looked at. Let's start with this proposition. Most of these cases, not all of them, but most are brought under something called the Equal Pay Act of 1963. And that law requires equal pay for equal work done under similar working conditions. Those are very technical definitions. It's equal pay for equal work, that is to say, substantially identical work done under similar working conditions, regardless of gender. So the first step that the EEOC will look at is to analyze whether the work being done is actually equal. Let me pose a hypothetical to illustrate. Suppose you have a male faculty teaching and grading 100 students who is paid more for the course than a female teaching the same course to 10 students in a seminar fashion. Is their work equal? And you can see that the EEOC may argue, sure, they both teach. They both develop a curriculum. They both go to class. They both have lectures. They both grade papers. And the argument is the work is equal. On the other hand, the institution may argue, well, the work isn't equal at all. And for those on the call who have graded papers, they'll know the truth of the old saw that we adjuncts, we would teach for free, we're paid to grade papers, because that's really the hard part of what we do. And so you can argue that that work is not equal. So there are fights first about whether the work is actually equal or done under substantially equal or similar working conditions. Second, even if the work that is being done is equal work, the employer can avoid liability if it can show that the difference in pay is based on, quote, factors other than sex, close quote. So, for example, let's assume that you have a male and a female paid $50,000 each as lecturers, and you're recruiting for a third lecturer, and you find a really good one, but the lecturer comes from a job where he or she was paid $55,000, and so you need to pay them $56,000 to lure them to join your faculty. Does that automatically mean that you have to bump up the existing people to $56,000 to avoid an equal pay problem? The answer probably is no, at least not initially, because a hiring premium necessary to recruit may be a factor, you see, other than sex, because it would be applied whether the new applicant was male or female. But over time, certainly, salaries have to be normalized. So these are difficult statistical analyses. One thing, though, that the EEOC is doing is increasingly looking at broader statistics in every significant area of discrimination analysis. It will look at the average salary for females in a particular institution or department and see if they are paid on the average less than males. Now, that alone isn't necessarily a violation of the law. In fact, there was a very interesting study that was reported in the New York Times on September 27th of this year, talking about the percentage of women in management. This is a GAO study just released that said that actually the percentage of women in management positions declined from 40% in some years ago, 1991, I think, to 39%, and that women generally were paid 80% of what men were paid in a broad statistical way. And these broad statistics do not necessarily show discrimination. As the GAO study suggested, there are many factors that may have led women to select lower-paying jobs by self-selection or preference because of schedule flexibility and other variables. So those broad statistics don't prove the case, but the EEOC is increasingly paying attention to them and is looking very, very carefully at broad statistics as well as immediate and narrow pay comparisons.
Okay, I think that's a very helpful point to make. Kathleen, in 2008, Congress passed the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act. Can you briefly explain what that act did and how it affects employers?
Sure, Hillary. The act overturned a 2007 Supreme Court case that restricted how long employees had, in terms of time, to bring a legal challenge if they believed that they were being discriminated against based upon pay. The Supreme Court in the 2007 case said that unlawful acts occur when a discriminatory pay decision is first made. That is, the statute of limitations or the clock begins to run from that point. The problem under that case is that very often that clock started running before an individual was even aware of any alleged discriminatory conduct. Under the Fair Pay Act, under the Ledbetter Fair Pay Act, an unlawful practice, pay practice occurs when the discriminatory decision is made, or when an employee becomes subject to it, or when an employee is actually affected by it. The result is that each discriminatory paycheck constitutes a separate illegal act and creates another opportunity for an employee to sue alleging discrimination.
Okay. Rich, have you seen much effect yet from the Ledbetter Fair Pay Act among your own higher education clients?
Not so much in terms of immediate action, but there is a growing awareness that Ledbetter and a related development that I'll mention in a minute create an increasing need to look hard at these questions of gender equity. The Ledbetter law is a lawyer's law. What it does is extend the statute of limitations to the indefinite past for someone who claims that over the course, I will say, of her career, it could be a male, but over the course of her career has been paid less than males similarly situated. The problems with it are enormous because it may be very difficult to reconstruct why something was done 15 years ago when there are no longer witnesses or records that really show what occurred. So there is a problem, but it is not a problem that can easily be addressed. One simply can't begin to gather records from 15 years ago on the off chance there might be a claim later on. More importantly, I think, people are watching very, very carefully a related development, and that is a case called Dukes versus Walmart. Dukes versus Walmart is a class action that claimed gender discrimination in pay on behalf of all female managers at Walmart. And it essentially had two components. It said, number one, the length of time it took for females to be promoted into management was longer than the length of time for males. And number two, the absolute amount of pay of female managers who were promoted was less than males similarly situated. And what this class action has certified has allowed is litigating what we call a wall-to-wall claim, and that is an entire class action based on those statistics alone, and not looking to see whether at the Fort Worth store Ms. Jones was actually doing the same thing as Mr. Smith, but rather using this broad statistical analysis. The Supreme Court of the United States has been asked to review the case. It will look at it this year, and I think that educational institutions, like other large employers, are looking very, very carefully to see whether this kind of very broad theory will be approved by the courts. But one thing I do tell my institutional clients is this. The question of pay equity will never, ever be resolved until we absolutely narrow some of these historic pay gaps, that there is something there that needs to be analyzed and it needs to be understood. It's a very important issue socially and legally, and it should be addressed even regardless of how these class actions come out.
Okay. Now, some institutions have really already started preparing for that possible future by doing gender pay equity studies. Others are doing such studies because of internal complaints or threatened litigation, usually, though not always, by women. Rich, what advice would you give to institutions contemplating such an equity study?
Well, first of all, these things, I think, are very, very technical analyses. So advice number one is don't do this at home. Don't do this in a halfway or informal way. These are complicated issues. And once you do a study, unless it's done only under the attorney-client privilege, it will be there for anyone to use, including those who would bring litigation against you. Number next, a good expert, a labor economist or a statistician of some kind, It is expensive, but often well worth it, because people with that kind of technical background are much better equipped to deal with all the possible variables and explain why differences may or may not be the result of illegal gender discrimination. That certainly was one of the reported conclusions in the GAO study that I mentioned earlier, suggesting that women selecting certain lower-paying, certain jobs that happen to be lower-paying as a class may contribute somewhat to that 80% statistic. There are fewer women in certain high-paying finance jobs or as VPs of sales, for example, than there are in HR or other related jobs in various non-university institutions. Next, it's a good idea in doing any liability study, whether it's affirmative action or liability, to do it first under the attorney-client privilege so that one gets a sense of the data before one commissions a full study or publishes the results of the study. And finally, here is an area in which interaction with colleagues, with UE, with other professionals in the higher education and education environment is really, really important. Find out who has done this sort of thing. Ask a lot of questions. Get someone who really understands the pay structure in education, the challenges faced in education. If it's a faculty study, understands the tenure system, understands other aspects of the institution, so that you don't get somebody who's inexperienced and run the risk of a less accurate result.
That's excellent advice. Kathleen, what advice might you offer education clients about gender pay equity studies?
Well, in addition to the great advice that Rich just provided, I would, Hillary, sum up this section by providing a few other practical follow-up or next step action points. And that is, first, it's important to have a discussion with the top administrators, whether it's in the school district or whether it's on a higher education campus, to really have a discussion and get buy-in from them and understanding that this is an issue of concern that needs to be addressed, that needs to be reviewed. Second, there needs to be an identification of legitimate business reasons and an understanding of what those legitimate business reasons to maintain pay disparities. Third, there should be a review of the compensation model on an annual basis, in light also of the recommendations that Rich just made. Next, there should be a review of job descriptions. Do they accurately reflect current job duties and requirements? Next, there should be an understanding of how positions are valued in the organization, and that understanding should be consistent across the administrative decision-maker level. Next, there should be an assessment of current pay practices, and as Rich mentioned, this requires some expert assistance. Next, for jobs of similar internal worth, the question then is the compensation equitable? Eighth, ensure your documentation is accurate regarding employee reviews and associated pay increases. Next, make sure you have an effective document retention policy. You, under the scope of this act now and its the implications over time, is that we may actually need to keep employment records for more than 7 years. And finally, as has been mentioned in the two previous sections, effective training and in-services for supervisors at all levels will be essential. It's important for administrators to work with HR and to work with legal counsel to understand the significance of this law, and for those who are charged with the implementation of and legal compliance under this law, it's really essential that training is ongoing and helpful and provides practical advice.
Thank you both. And now we'll go into our third and final question and answer period. Again, send your email questions to risk@ue.org, or if you want to call in, press star 1 on your phone and you'll be put in line to ask a question. If you decide that you don't want to ask your question after all, press the pound key and that will remove you from the queue. We have one question, Kathleen, that actually goes back to our segment on the ADA amendments. The EOC recently issued proposed regulations under the amendments to the ADA. What are some of the more significant things that you saw covered in those proposed regulations?
Well, it's important to remember and to understand that the EEOC, that the definition of substantially limits a major life activity has now been defined to be less demanding. Previously, major life activity had to be significantly or severely restricted. The standard now under the amendments is whether someone is substantially limited in a major life activity as compared to most people in the general population. So there is a lessening of the restriction, a lessening of the demand imposed under the concept of substantially limits. Another concern here and clarification under the amendments is that impairments are, we want to take a look at whether impairments will consistently qualify as disabilities, such as many physical conditions or psychological disorders, such as major depression or bipolar disorder or obsessive compulsive disorder. So it's really going to be important that we understand what has automatically been defined as a disability now under the amendments, and what other impairments may require further analysis. And so it also is important, finally, to understand that for some individuals, certain conditions may be substantially limiting, but that may not be the case for other individuals. We talked about that a little while ago with the example of asthma and the sensitivity to perfume. That may differ from person to person. We also may have significant differences from person to person for back or leg impairments or for learning disabilities that exist between and among individuals. So the clarity provided now under these amendments is to provide much more specificity with regard to impairments that will automatically be considered a disability under the amendments as compared to those that may require some further analysis.
Okay, thank you very much. And that should wrap things up for today. Unfortunately, we're out of time. I'd like to ask our participants again to please complete the evaluation form. We read all of your comments and use your feedback to improve our roundtable series. That concludes today's program, and you may now disconnect.